instead of the analyst being in a position where they know something about the patient, they are with the patient. As Winnicott says in his late work, if you're a philosopher in your armchair, you have to come out of your armchair and be on the floor with the child playing. Now, I don't think one should sort of act that out with an adult patient. However, it's that approach to actually being with the patient, listening to the patient's words, listening to their state of mind without preconceived ideas. Now, that's almost impossible, but Winnicott said somewhere that psychoanalysis is an objective study, an objective way of looking at things without preconceived ideas, without preconceived notions. And I think it links with what you've just said about normative. If we go into the consulting room feeling that our patients need to be as we are or need to fit into some kind of norm, then I don't think this is psychoanalytic. I think it's against the whole aim of psychoanalysis.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest host today is Dr. Joel Whitebook. Joel and I first had a conversation back in October 2020 when we discussed his work on magic and psychoanalysis and religion. It's episode 68. It was I recently listened to it again, and it still is quite alive. And Joel has this wonderful ability to dig deeply into these subjects, as you will hear today. Joel also was a guest host back in May 2021, episode 86, when he interviewed his friend and colleague Fred Pine, not long before Fred passed away. And Joel is back, and he interviews Professor Jan Abram, who is a Winnicott scholar. She's a training and supervising analyst at the British Psychoanalytic, as you'll hear. But she really is a deeply immersed in the thinking and riches of Winnicott's writing. She differentiates his thinking from Freud and Klein, and there's much to learn. Joel Whitebook is a philosopher and psychoanalyst. He's on the faculty of the Columbia University Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research and was the founding director of the university's Psychoanalytic Studies Program. He's written very widely on psychoanalysis, philosophy, and critical theory. His early book was Perversion and Utopia, but he's best known, and reasonably enough, best known for his masterful biography of Freud, Freud, an intellectual biography. Just as one will learn much more about Winnicott today than one knew, Likewise, no matter how well-versed one is in Freud biography and literature, you will learn more in reading Freud and intellectual biography. And now I will turn it over to Joel, who will introduce Jan.
Harvey, thank you for inviting me to be the host for another episode of the podcast. It's a great pleasure not only to do that, but to also be interviewing Jan Abram, whose work I've come to appreciate more and more over the past couple of years. Jan is perhaps one of the most important Winnicott scholars in the world, as well as being a theorist in her own right who has taken up Winnicott's project and elaborated. She's a training and supervising analyst at the British Psychoanalytic Society and in private practice in London. She is a visiting professor of the Psychoanalysis Unit, University College London, and currently vice president of the European Psychoanalytic Federation for the annual conferences. She is president-elect of the EPF to start her term in March 2024. And she's a visiting lecturer and supervisor at the Tavistock Clinic, London. In 2016, she was visiting professor at the University of Kyoto, Japan, where she resided for a writing sabbatical. I won't list all of her publications, but I want to emphasize two of them. Along with Bob Henshelwood, she published two books, dialogues, where the two of them discuss the differences between Winnicott and Klein in the first and Winnicott and Beyond in the second. There are also wonderful webinars on the IPA website where the two of them discuss these issues as well. The reason I mention them because they're really exemplary in the sense that two colleagues focused on and debated essential issues in a completely non-contentious and professional way. And the other publication I'll mention, which has become a classic, is her book, The Language of Winnicott. In fact, it was discovering that book that made me reevaluate or see Winnicott in a different way and has been enormously important for me in my own work over the last several years. I compare the book to Laplanche and Pontalise's The Language of Psychoanalysis. She did for Winnicott what Laplanche and Pontalise did for psychoanalysis in general. And it's an enormously useful book. It's along with Laplanche and Pontalise, I think it's a unique scholarly work. But what I found so important about it was this. I had been teaching Winnicott for many years. I taught a post-Freud class, so I taught him regularly. And each year, I realized how great he was, and I discovered new things about him. But it wasn't until I came across Jan's Language of Winnicott that I discovered what a systematic thinker he is. Because he has such an idiosyncratic style, which is seemingly informal, and we tend to think that he's not systematic and he's more impressionistic. But taking up Jan's Language of Psychoanalysis, I came to see that beneath this informal idiosyncratic facade or presentation that we all like so much, there's really a deep and systematic theory. And Jan's explanation of why it took so long to realize that is because of the order in which his works were published. They weren't published in a systematic way. They were published sort of sporadically or not non-systematically. So as a result, it wasn't clear how deep a system of thought underlay his thinking. So with those comments, I think it's always to begin on a personal note, and I'll invite Jan to tell us something about her background, how she became a psychoanalyst and what drew her to Winnicott. Jan?
Thank you very much, Joel, and thank you, Harvey, for inviting me for this IPA podcast. It's a great honor to be here and have an opportunity to talk about my work. And thank you very much for all that you've said about Language of Winnicott. So my professional life actually began in the theatre many decades ago. But quite soon, I became interested in theatre and education. And I joined a touring theatre company that took short plays to schools where audience participation was at least 50% of the performance. And the aims of the group were based on the premise that children learn much better when they play. And so as actors, we facilitated playing by bringing the audience, the children, into our world. We had very few props. We worked in the round, but we were very serious about our characters that we were playing, a la Stanislavski, you know, An Actor Prepares and Being a Character, which in the 60s I studied to great extent. Now, Brian Way was the person who had set up this theatre in education, and he based his work on a man called Peter Slade, who wrote three very important books, Child Play, Its Importance for Human Development, Experience and Spontaneity, and An Introduction to Child Drama. So these publications were aimed at teachers, especially drama teachers, working with all age groups. Actually, I realised that the books were published quite recently. They were published in the 60s. And it's very interesting that Winnicott never mentioned them, and they never mentioned Winnicott's work. So I wonder if it was just in the zeitgeist, especially in the UK at that time. After that experience, I had my own children. And so for a while, I left the theatre. And after that experience of having children and obviously being a mother, I was interested in working in therapeutic communities. I had a few friends at that time through my circle in North London, and the anti-psychiatry movement, especially around R.D. Lang, became something of a talking point. And I followed two postgraduate courses after my children had gone back, had started school. And one of them was drama and movement in therapy. One was drama therapy. And I became a drama therapist in a day hospital. Now, I think it must have been because I don't see myself as terribly disturbed at that time, but it's quite a thing to be having children, we all know, and they do test you in all sorts of ways. And working as a drama therapist in a psychiatric day unit certainly influenced me and influenced what I started to want to do. Instead of going into the theatre after having children, I decided I might like to think about therapeutic work. I was definitely influenced by very close friends at that time. Because of my unconventional background, the Psychoanalytic Institute didn't seem the right place. And because of being influenced by the work of Joseph Burke and R.D. Lang, I decided to do a psychotherapy course with the Arbors Association. And that association was very much came out of the anti-psychiatry movement. Joseph Burke, who set it up, wrote a book with Mary Barnes. This was the therapeutic community he lived and worked in with R.D. Lang in the early 1960s. After setting up private practice I then decided to train with the British Society. In the Arbors Association, interestingly, although it was a very thorough and excellent training, I have to say, and we had to, they did have therapeutic communities, and we did have to work in these therapeutic communities, not live in them, but spend many hours with the participants there, and I learned a great deal. However, the theory was very Kleinian. And there was only one paper on Winnicott's that we studied, which happened to be The Mirror Role of Mother. I'd already read The Child, the Family, and the Outside World in the 1970s when bringing up my own children. And after that, after the qualification and being in private practice, I came across the organisation, the Squiggle Foundation. There were 8 Saturday mornings on the original themes of Donald Winnicott. And I didn't understand why an organisation had been set up to study his work. But I was intrigued. Who was this author? Why did I know so little about him? And why wasn't his work really being discussed in the mainstream? On that course, I met Marion Milner, who was a regular participant. She was in her 90s. But she was as sharp as anything, and I learned a lot from her and the discussions on those very precious memories of those Saturday mornings. By the end of my time on that course, and then quite soon I was invited to teach, and eventually I became director of the Squiggle Foundation a decade later, and that's when I published Language of Winnicott. I had invited colleagues to join me, but they just told me it's not possible to write a book on Winnicott's work, and you shouldn't. It's against the Winnicott grain. But I did it for myself to begin with. And then in conversation with Andre Green, said, look, I'm preparing this. What do you think? He said, let me have a look at it. And then Cesare Sacerdoti of Karnak Books published it, and that was the first edition in 1996. But at first, I didn't really think it was going to be something that other people would be interested in or even influenced by. So it's lovely to hear what you said at the beginning, Joel.
I had never heard you talk about your background with people who were involved in the anti-psychiatry movement. And that foreshadows a theme that we're going to get into today, which you and I talked about yesterday, which is really the problem of health normalization, heteronormativity, and all these topics which are so current in the psychoanalytic debates today. I just want to foreshadow that. We'll come back to it when we talk about Winnicott's concept of health, and on his understanding of the role of the biological mother. But before we get to that, maybe this bears on that. I mean, the title you've chosen for today's episode is Why Winnicott? And I take that to mean that you think that in this pluralistic psychoanalytic world today, which seems to be moving in so many different directions at once, that Winnicott can provide a special role in helping us articulate ourselves and find our way. So why Winnicott?
Thank you. Yes. I mean, this was the title of my introduction to my recent book on the surviving object. I think what I point out is that I feel that what Winnicott offers, and I think Thomas Ogden has recently articulated this so beautifully, is an ontological psychoanalysis rather than an epistemological. So instead of the analyst being in a position where they know something about the patient, they are with the patient. As Winnicott says in his late work, if you're a philosopher in your armchair, you have to come out of your armchair and be on the floor with the child playing. Now, I don't think one should sort of act that out with an adult patient. However, it's that approach to actually being with the patient, listening to the patient's words, listening to their state of mind without preconceived ideas. Now, that's almost impossible, but Winnicott said somewhere that psychoanalysis is an objective study, an objective way of looking at things without preconceived ideas, without preconceived notions. And I think it links with what you've just said about normative. If we go into the consulting room feeling that our patients need to be as we are or need to fit into some kind of norm, then I don't think this is psychoanalytic. I think it's against the whole aim of psychoanalysis. And so I think this is what I feel Winnicott broadens and deepens the psychoanalytic project without negating Freud's work. I've had long discussions with a philosopher called Jelko Loparek in Brazil, who believes that Winnicott has negated the need for Freud's work. I completely disagree with him. I think what he brings is a new perspective that we can add to the psychoanalytic agenda.
Okay, that actually leads into the next two questions I want to ask, because there is indeed a whole school of thought that thinks that Winnicott introduced a new paradigm which broke with Freud or replaced Freud. And as you just said, you're of the opinion, and Andre Green agrees with it, that that Winnicott didn't break with Freud, but that he completed it. He filled in what was missing in Freud's work. So two of the topics that people who advocate the position that Winnicott broke with Freud, two of the topics that come up are, or what's the first one that comes up is that they believe that Freud, that Winnicott, because he introduced the role of the environment, and this was his distinctive contribution against the Kleinians, because they argue that because he introduced the role of the environment, that he minimized the role of the unconscious and psychic reality. So could you say something about that?
Yes. Before saying, sort of addressing the environment, let me say something about the one concept that Winnicott disagreed on with Freud and indeed Klein, which was the death instinct.
I'm actually going to ask, that's my next question.
Okay, so that's related to the theory of aggression, isn't it, in Winnicott's work. The environment, you see, I think we have to, I always write about the environment as a psychic environment. And I think this is what people, I think it's a bit of a clunky term, actually. And I think when Winnicott refers to the environment, he really is talking about the mother's mind, the mother's psyche. I prefer to think of the mother's psyche body, actually. I often put that with a hyphen. Because it's about her emotionality and her feelings and her psychic presence with the infant. I think that's what he means by the environment. And I think many analysts, as well as relationists, miss that point because he's profoundly psychoanalytic. And this is what I explored in The Surviving Object, that really he inaugurates what I've called an intrapsychic surviving object, which I'll go on to talk about in more detail later. So does that answer your question, Joel, about the environment?
Okay, so I'll take up the next question, which I interrupted you about. Another key point that people who argue that Winnicott introduced a radical paradigm break with Freud is that he rejected Freud's theory of aggression and destructiveness. Now, you argue not only did Winnicott have a theory of aggression, beginning with primitive aggression and developing into something much more advanced and sophisticated, but even perhaps even more significantly, that Winnicott thought that destructiveness played an essential role in the constitution of the object and reality, something Freud didn't fully appreciate. I mean, in the Use of the Object paper, he talks about destructiveness and the role it plays in what he says, placing the object outside the sphere of omnipotence, which he says in that paper is the most important task in development. So could you comment on that, please?
Yeah. So as I began, he was really vehement that there was no such thing as a death instinct. And he, of course, he wasn't the only Freudian who took that point of view. We still have Freudians in the British society and elsewhere who disagree with that concept of the death instinct. But of course, in London, Melanie Klein was really running with the ball of the death instinct to such an extent that my view is that the death instinct, the Kleinian death instinct, is completely different from the Freudian death instinct. Winnicott disagreed with both versions, I think. What he saw was that aggression is benign at the beginning. It's muscle erotism, it's energy, it's what he described as the spontaneous gesture. And to think of the infant with hate, sadism, and envy, this is Klein's version of the death instinct, as innate, he completely disagreed and felt that she was imbuing the infant with far too much maturity. So for him, hate, sadism, and envy were developmental achievements. It's not that they did not exist. It's that they had to evolve in the context of the early relationship. So his idea of the paranoid schizoid position was not that it was a universal infantile state of mind, but that it was actually an example of the deficiency of the early holding environment. Now, as you say, as rightly say, he evolved that theory, and actually the first entry in the language of Winnicott is aggression, where there are, I think, 10 or 11 subheadings to that entry. And it shows, I think, the evolution of his idea of primary aggression through to later aggression. And you quite rightly point out that in his late work, The Survival of the Object, in his paper, The Use of an Object, defines the formulation of survival of the object. There are five sequences. It's a sort of five-step sequence in that paper. The subject relates to the object. The second one is that the object is in the process of being found. The third is that the subject destroys the object. The fourth is that the object survives the destruction. And the fifth is that then subject can use object. It's in that sequence that I picked up that my interpretation, of course, that Winnicott inaugurates an intrapsychic surviving object. And that's the concept I've been working on since the 90s. I call it the Ariadne thread of my work. It's always there in everything I write about. This notion of this dynamic that starts from the beginning and continues even to this conversation now, where there's a destruction and survival, hopefully survival of the object, which means that I liken it to a kind of psychic eating where you're taking in and destroying, but it's not damaging. It's a benign destruction. And it's like meeting someone who you know really well and seeing something different or having a new experience with them. That's a good, and I hope that happens. I feel I keep that alive with my patients, being open to seeing something different every time. This is psychic survival of the object.
And he makes it clear, as you're saying, that it doesn't happen once and for all, but it's an ongoing process. It's with us throughout our lives.
Exactly. Right until our death. That's when he said, "Oh God, may I be alive when I die."
Yes, fantastic. It's a fantastic game.
Yeah.
Okay, so coming back to something I alluded to before, namely the whole question of normativity, the goal of analysis, the goal of development, and that whole family of topics, I'd like to ask you two questions. The first has to do with the concept of health. Now, many analysts since Freud have been very reluctant to spell out explicitly a concept of analysis, of health, of what the goal of development is, what the goal of analysis is. I mean, with Freud, it came out of, for one place it came out of was his break with hypnosis and his not wanting to use suggestion. In fact, for him, he thought that was the defining feature that separated analysis from other forms of psychotherapy. Now, you know, we have many critics of analysis from the beginning until today that say it's prescriptive, it's normalizing, it's heteronormative. I mean, there are many variations on this theme. So the specific question I want to ask you is this. Winnicott is opposed to this tradition, is completely unabashed about embracing the concept of health. In the paper on location of cultural experience, he criticizes other analysts for failing to develop one. And he says, we need to have a concept of health. We need to have a concept of what life is all about. That's his term. And he sets out to develop one. So there, I guess there are two questions embedded in this. The first is, what did he mean by health? I mean, things like creative living and so on and so forth. But also, and we discussed this yesterday, what's unique about him is at the same time as he has a concept of health, he's one of the least normalizing analysts there are. He's one of the least prescriptive, pathologizing analysts that we know of, the one can cite. I mean, one only has to read his review of Jung's memoirs when he fully acknowledges Jung's childhood schizophrenia, but he says in a way it even has an advantage over Freud because Freud had to flee into health or normality. So I'm just inviting you to talk about Winnicott's concept of health and the fact that he could combine it with a stance which wasn't pathologizing or stigmatizing.
Yes, it's very interesting, this area, isn't it? Because it could appear to be very prescriptive,
right, and
very rigid. But you see, in his writings, you always get a sense that he came to psychoanalysis for his own illness. He says, "I was ill, and I needed analysis." And I think all of us come into psychoanalysis because we know something's not quite working. And we're not living life to the full, so to speak, in ordinary language. And he was very interested in outlining, well, what is the concept of health? What does it mean to feel good about yourself, to feel that you are living in your body, that your body is yourself? And really, I think his answer was related to what happens right at the very beginning. And his whole concept of trauma, I think, and early psychic development and what might happen at the beginning and the pattern of relating, as he refers to it. You know, very early on in the 40s and the 50s, he was outlining this pattern of development that he says never changes, so that if you are traumatized at the beginning, you can find a way of managing that trauma, but you can never cure it. And later in life, and that's where analysis comes in, and certainly the concept of regression, you're going to have to go back to that early trauma and live through it and work through it in order to get where you feel you need to be, where you feel a whole person. And I think this is all related to what you were saying earlier about discernment, about the capacity to see the other as separate and different, which is the whole of his theory of the use of an object and survival of the object.
One of the other things he says in that paper on the location of cultural experience, when he talks about addressing the question of what life is all about, he actually says that our more disturbed patients are the ones who can teach us about the answer to that question. So it's not the normal people, it's not the healthy people who can teach us what life is all about. He says it's actually the more disturbed ones. And this is very similar to what Lowald says in the Winning of the Oedipus Complex paper. And I think Lowald was deeply influenced by Winnicott, where he says that our more disturbed patients, because they're dealing with the fundamental issues of separation and separate existence and so on, can teach us the most about the, I hate to use the term, but something about the essence of human nature, human experience.
Yes, you remind me that, of course, although everyone thinks he's interested in early psychic development because he was a pediatrician, in fact, what he says towards the end of his life, that he learned far more about infantile states of mind from the regressed patient on the couch than he ever did when working with families, which is quite a statement, really. But I think it comes from what he also says is he learned more about infantile states of mind from his analysis, his personal analysis in the first 5 years of his analysis. And of course, that was with James Strachey.
This brings up another point about the analyst who claimed that Winnicott represented a radical paradigm break with Freud. Because they claim Winnicott for their position. I'm thinking of people who advocate two-person psychology, relational people, and so on. They not only claim that Winnicott supports their position, but they also claim that infant research supports their position. But this is really at odds with what Winnicott explicitly said, as you just mentioned. And of course, it was the topic of a famous debate between Dan Stern and Andre Green, where Stern argued for the priority of infant research and Green argued for the priority of clinical experience.
Yes, absolutely. And this is something I actually attended that conference. It was 1992. And it was a very, very important conference. And it's not that Winnicott was against, or indeed Green was against, infant research. It's that crucial point that you make, that advances in psychoanalysis come about from the consulting room, high-frequency analysis, and the single case study. This is the research. This is the research of psychoanalysis. It's not to dismiss the importance of applied psychoanalysis, but in my view, you can't apply psychoanalysis unless you have the gold of analysis, as Freud referred to it.
Given what you just said, and I'll ask a bit of a provocative question, I would assume that you are in favor of maintaining many sessions a week for people who are becoming psychoanalysts, rather than reducing the number of hours for training for personal analysis for people who are going to become analysts.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And obviously, I'm a keen advocate of five times weekly. That's the analytic culture I'm in. And after the pandemic, despite the fact that it was quite clear that patients were continuing to evolve their capacity for psychic work, nevertheless, I'm of the opinion that working in the room is essential. And I base this on the appendix in Surviving Object book, where in, remember the footnote in The Use of an Object, where Winnicott talks about how important it is that the analyst is completely, that the patient is completely uninhibited when working with the analyst and can bring all their rage and all their destructive feelings to the analyst. Survival of the object can only happen in the room, in my view. His footnote is, if the patient comes in with a revolver, this work cannot be done. And I think that's what happened in the pandemic. The revolver was COVID. And we were all frightened and we all went away and had to work online. But we had to come back. And many people feel it's not, there's no point in going back. You don't need to go back. But for me, it was absolutely crucial to be back in the room with the patient is essential. The odd session online is fine, but basically being in the room is essential.
And I would say that it also follows that in order for an analyst to be able to survive and to take all the attacks, he or she must have himself or herself undergone a very, very deep analysis where they're at home with psychic life and destructiveness and aren't frightened by it.
Exactly. It can't be done intellectually. And that comes back to the whole thing of ontology and being with your patient. And as Ferenczi pointed out, being a step ahead and being taken into areas that might be, well, will be uncomfortable. And it's not as if you've done it all before. Hopefully, with your own analyst, you have gone to the depth that you need to have gone to. But yes, I think this is what strengthens the analyst psyche.
Okay, Jen, prepare yourself. I'm going to ask you what the cognitive psychologists and the people who are doing research into consciousness call the really hard question. And it has to do, well, I'll actually read it. Many feminists and members of the LGBTQ community criticize Winnicott for essentializing and idealizing the role of the mother. It is true that Winnicott believed that the biological mother was in the best position to raise her infant, but he also talked about other situations in which a caregiving figure could be good enough. For example, in cases of adoption. Yet he seemed to believe or he seemed to favor the idea that the biological mother was in the best position owing to the experience of pregnancy and giving birth. A view which, if I'm not mistaken, you tend to share. There's something essential about the mother's body. What are we to make out of this view in a world in which there are new reproductive technologies and same-sex couples are becoming prevalent?
Yeah, the $64 million question.
Yeah, $64 million question.
Well, look, I really believe it's incumbent on all psychoanalysts to face the challenges now about our theories from all groups, and especially the LGBTQ community. How can we not? The research and the literature is growing, and the analytic approach, perhaps, is the only approach that can offer a space to explore what it means to feel your body is not the body you feel is yourself. Now, from my point of view, following Winnicott, of course, there can be no true division between biology and the psyche. What is biological has an effect on the psyche. the nascent psyche. And I do believe that the mother is the most powerful person in the world for all human beings. I think that's a fact. This is not a sought-for power. I think the woman's body is both real and symbolic, and it's only a woman who has a womb, and men cannot give birth, even though they can and do co-parent. And this does tie in with Winnicott's concept of the fear of woman. And what I've suggested is his theory of misogyny, in fact. It needs a lot more development. But the question of who is the best person to mother the child is complicated because it must depend on circumstances. What happens to the mind of the infant? I heard about a child therapy case. This child, as an infant, was taken away from their mother as soon as they were born because the mother, because the pregnancy was an incestuous rape. What happens to that child and what happens to the child's mind? One of my patients, I remember many years ago, told me that from a really young age, she felt that her father was not her biological father, and it made her feel mad. And later on, her mother did, in fact, confirm that the father was not her biological father. I think madness arises, and here we go back to the concept of madness, in all human beings when we don't know the truth about our origins. Freud showed us how it's the fundamental question in all very young children. Where do we come from? Here in the UK, a woman who had been conceived by artificial insemination by donor many years ago set up a campaign to make this illegal, and she won her case. She said it made her feel mad that she could not track down the donor. Now all donors have to reveal their name, and for me, this indicates a human responsibility to the unborn child. So following Freud, I feel disavowal and negation of a biological reality leads to mental disturbance. If an infant is brought up by a rainbow family where the facts of their origins are openly discussed and revealed at appropriate developmental stages, then the biological facts, I feel, can be integrated with a sense of self in the context of loving and concerned people who are in a position of parenting. This is the crucial point for me. Who has the desire to parent and offer a sustained continuity and reliability to the evolving child?
But you're saying good parenting must involve being honest about biological reality.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we could go on, and there are many questions that follow from this and which I'd like to explore with you, but unfortunately, we've run out of time. So thank you for a rich and very articulate discussion, Jan.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.